From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Out of work and no longer looking. For millions of American workers, the layoffs that brought up the rear of the go-go 90s have led to a gig of another sort, full-time joblessness by choice. There they join the millions of workers we didn't hear about in that fantastic decade, who, sick of vying for too few jobs that paid too few dollars, simply dropped out. The welfare state declared dead, they found a faintly beating pulse. Disability payments have nearly doubled in the last decade. And then the other way to be permanently non-employed, of course, is to be in prison, living off a different kind of government program. It's all bad news for economic policymakers who've got to balance free market ideology with conscience. On Point listeners, what do you think? Can recession-gripped America afford to leave anyone else behind? And how much faith should be put in one major economic indicator, the unemployment rate, if millions of Americans live below its radar? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I spoke earlier today with Kevin Murphy, the George J. Stigler Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago. 12 years ago, he co-wrote a paper for the Brookings Institution predicting bleak times ahead for those looking for jobs. Then, of course, the go-go 90s intervened, but he recently co-authored an updated study, Current Unemployment Historically Contemplated. I asked him to explain his study's conclusion that the unemployment rate doesn't tell the whole story about the state of joblessness in America.
Well, you always have to remember when you look at the labor market that there are really three categories. There's a category of people who are working, that's the employed. There's a category of people who are looking for work, that's the unemployed. And then there's a category called out of the labor force, who are people who are not working but not currently looking for work. Some of those might be, say, on disability. Some of those might be just out of the labor force and for some reason or another are not currently seeking a job. And what we've seen over time is that while over the 90s we saw a fall in the number that were unemployed, those classified as looking for work, that was actually made up not by an increase in the number of people working, but rather by an increase in the number of people who were in this out-of-the-labor-force category not working.
How did it come to be that the Department of Labor has decided that people who have just given it up are not to be considered unemployed?
Well, you have to remember that the Department of Labor has to look at the statistics in a broad way. And, you know, for example, go back in time, there were a large number of women who were out of work, were not working because they were in the household, say, raising children and the like. And you really wouldn't want to lump those people in with the unemployed. That would give you a very misleading picture of what's going on in terms of how, you know, how tight or slack the labor market is. The fact that, you know, 40% or 50% or whatever the number was at a given point in history of the females at a given age were in the household rather than in the market, you wouldn't say, boy, there's a ton of people who can't find work. Unfortunately, what's happened over time that's made the statistics a little less meaningful is we've seen a substantial rise in this out-of-the-labor-force category among groups of men that we traditionally think of as spending most of their time working, say, men in their, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, what you might think of as prime-age males, for whom we sort of ask the question, well, why is it that so many of them are now are out of work and not even looking for work currently? And so,
how do you answer that question?
Well, I think the basic story is over the last several decades, we've seen a decline in the opportunities in the market for low-skilled males. That is, males, say, with less than a high school education or even some with a high school education, they're competing at the low end of the labor market. We've seen wages and employment opportunities falling rather dramatically for that group. And with less opportunities in the market and alternatives such as disability insurance or, you know, non-market activities, we've seen more and more males withdraw from the labor force at that low end. So the opportunities may be there. Maybe they could find a job, but the wages are at a low enough level that it's not really worth, you know, for them, on their own basis, they don't say it's worth going to work at those wages.
Now, one of the interesting things in your study is you note that the highest rates of, let's call it non-employment as opposed to unemployment, seem to coincide with large economic expansions?
You know, we've had high rates of non-employment, you know, just to sort of let's think about it that way. Let me kind of give you the idea. So if we go back and look at what happened over the 90s, if you look at unemployment, you'll see that unemployment actually fell from around 4.5% in the late 80s down to about 3% in 2000. Over that same period, though, we saw the number of people out of the labor force rise by exactly a compensating amount, so that by the time we get to 2000, we have only 3% of this male labor force here unemployed, but we have 8% in this out-of-the-labor force category for a total of 11% in the non-employment category. That gives you an idea of how big it is and how important looking at this sort of forgotten group is when trying to understand what's going on in the market.
What about prison population? The number of men in prison has grown exponentially a lot with, you know, three strikes and you're out kind of laws, with draconian laws on drug possession. Do you figure those men into your non-employment statistics?
No, actually, they're not even counted, because we base ours on the same statistics the government uses for unemployment, and those are surveys of households and other non-institutional populations. So
that's an extra, say, 2 million men not being counted. That's not a small number of working-age people.
No, that would add about another 1.5 points to the number we're talking about in terms of the long-term increase.
So then how would you characterize the already mythologized 1990s, the golden era, the longest expansion in peacetime in terms of employment? What was the real word to summarize that decade?
Well, I think, you know, there was a substantial expansion in the economy. I think we saw, you know, if you look at output and other statistics, a growth. And, you know, the 80s were pretty much the same story. But over the decade of the 90s, we did not see that kind of progress in the employment levels for particularly low-skilled groups of men. Those would be males toward the lower end of the education distribution, lower end of the occupational distribution. And for those men, what we really saw in the 90s was a fall in unemployment, not because they were moving into work, but because they were moving out of even looking for work into this out-of-the-labor force category. A fair number of those ended up on the disability rolls, actually.
Now, 12 years ago, when you wrote your paper for Brookings, Why Has the Natural Rate of Unemployment Increased Over Time?, and then which inspired your reassessment that we've just been discussing, did that give you a terminal case of the jitters about predicting the future?
You know, it was kind of funny because we sort of, when we, 12 years ago, like you said, we looked at the data and we said, well, the non-employment has been rising over a long period of time, and the forces that have been driving it up have been this fall in opportunities for less skilled men. And we said, well, there's no real sign that this is going to change anytime soon. Of course, we see the, you know, public data for the next 12 years, and we go, boy, were we wrong. But when we look back and actually looked in the data, the same sort of story was still there. We weren't so far off.
If you want to look ahead 5 to 10 years, what do you think the situation will be?
Well, I don't think things are going to get significantly worse in this regard, although I don't see any sign that's going to push them to get much better. I think we're going to have, barring some substantial change in institutional arrangements or something else, my guess is we're going to continue with a substantial level of joblessness, particularly among this group, for years to come. You know, I don't think we're going to go up from here, but I don't see it reversing itself either.
Kevin Murphy, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Kevin Murphy is the George J. Stigler, Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago. He co-authored the report, Current Unemployment, Historically Contemplated, and we were talking to him at his office in Chicago. Joining me now is David Leonhardt, National Economics Correspondent for the New York Times, and also joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello.
Jack. Hi. Anyway, listen, let me turn to David Leonhardt first. David, I'm still a little confused, and maybe you can help us. The history of the unemployment rate, it hasn't always been calculated in the same way. And we were just listening to Kevin Murphy pointing out all the millions of people who aren't even included in that rate, but who aren't working. How did we get to this point where you have a statistic that undercounts the jobless in this way?
The origin of the unemployment rate, which we read about in the papers every month or hear about on TV, actually is in your own state of Massachusetts. After the panic of 1873, there was a chief of the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Massachusetts named Carol Wright, and he was worried that the fears were too widespread about joblessness. So he commissioned a survey, and he had said that these ideas that joblessness was rampant were reckless ideas, and he wanted to prove them wrong. And they went out and they surveyed and they found that 22,000 men could be counted as unemployed. But the way they did the survey went a long way toward determining that number, and it also went a long way toward determining how we have counted unemployment for the last 130 years. You had to be able-bodied, however they defined that then, and you had to be actively seeking employment. And there's a nice history of this in a book called Out of Work, written by a Harvard professor named Alexander Kasar. And Carol Wright went on to become the first chief of the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics, which to this day issues the monthly employment report.
David, when did they decide to leave these non-employed out of the overall unemployment rate? Is that a recent event?
No, it's pretty much from the beginning.
Really? Has there been many major changes? I mean, interestingly, in Britain, I know that throughout the Thatcher era, as the transition, she forced that nation out of a social welfare economic model to a really rabid free market model, unemployment went up dramatically. And what they did is they simply recalculated how they found the unemployed and what qualified you to be unemployed, and were always able to keep the rate, you know, within a politically acceptable minimum. Has there ever been anything like that here?
Not to my knowledge. Instead, I think what's happened here is that the statistic has remained constant, but the reality has changed to make the statistic less telling than it used to be.
Jack Beatty, when you look at the, I'm sure that you pore over the release of the figures each month, do you feel confident that what the Bureau of Labor Statistics is telling us gives an accurate reflection of the, or is an accurate clue to the state of the American economy?
I don't. I haven't had faith in these metrics for a long time. The poverty line is another one. You know, when that method was devised in the 1960s, food accounted for about a quarter of the average family's budget, not 33% or 33%, I'm sorry, not 16%, which it is now, and housing accounted for 29%, not 37% as it does now, and the poverty basis is only figured out on the basis of food, not shelter. So the statistics about poverty are just inherently misleading, and I think that's the same thing with some of these other statistics. I know when Clinton was president, there was some controversy about tweaking these metrics.
David, do you remember that controversy?
I do not.
Well, maybe I'm making it up then, because you'd know it. But I thought there was some controversy about if we change the definition here, there'll be seem to be more unemployed than we would like to have politically, since it's a kind of bragging point. And I'm not sure whether that was to get in some of the discouraged workers or not. But these metrics are very rough measures, and whether of poverty or unemployment, and I think they err on the side of the government, of the administration, which is to minimize them, to make them seem as low as possible.
To the credit of the Department of Labor, it's worth pointing out that in their report, they describe what the unemployment rate is quite accurately. I think some of the problems come in the translation. It becomes thought of as the single way to measure the economic health of the nation.
We're going to be talking more about the reality of unemployment, non-employment, and just working for too little money for the rest of the hour. On Point listeners, 1-800-423-8255 to join in the conversation, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking in this hour about unemployment in America and non-employment, and that's two different things, although the end result is the same, people not working. We're talking about who's factored into the unemployment rate, who isn't, what it means for the economy as it's mired in recession. But we're also talking about people who are working at the very lowest end of the economic spectrum. And one person with experience of that low level, personal experience of that low level of employment, is Barbara Ehrenreich, who was the author of Nickel and Dimed, Not Getting By in America, detailing her working in three parts of the country at the lowest paid forms of work. And I spoke with her earlier today and asked her what she might expect to find if she tried getting a job in today's unskilled job market.
Well, it would not be quite so easy for me to get jobs. When I was doing this between 1998 and 2000, I mean, employers were begging you to come in and apply. Everywhere I went, employers considered that there was a labor shortage at that time. So, yeah, quite a difference. Now, I think it would not be so easy even to get these relatively poorly paid service and retail jobs.
Since in recent months, have you actually tried to make contact with anyone that you encountered while you were doing research for the book a couple of years ago, just to see how they're getting on?
Yes, I saw one friend from Walmart just a few weeks ago, and she's still working in the same job. So no impact there.
Now, in the past, at least looking at the male side of the job market, in these conditions of recession, not enough jobs, a lot of men would simply just stop working and leave the job market permanently and just get used to living on whatever small amount of benefit they could find. Do you think that women, particularly those who might be single mothers, have that option? Would you expect them to drop out, or are they going to have to look for something else anyway?
Well, I don't think either sex has much to fall back on. In the past, women, single mothers, had welfare to fall back on. What we learn now that what a lot of men have been doing is turning to disability insurance as if it were unemployment insurance, because anybody who's been working a few years probably has some sort of injury that they could use to get disability. But I think that's kind of sad when that's our substitute for unemployment insurance. If the economy continues to go downhill, we will hear more and more about the high unemployment and what a problem that is, and could we please have more jobs, what's going to generate jobs. And in my whole message, I guess, from my experience working on the book Nickel and Dimed, was it's not enough to have a job if those jobs don't pay enough to live on. And so the boom years of the 90s, when jobs are plentiful, was not a great time for a lot of people because those jobs just didn't pay enough.
So what you're saying then is that it isn't about creating jobs, it's about creating a certain kind of job.
Yeah.
And you would have said that in 1998 when people who had that certain kind of job were actually enjoying life quite a lot. But what you're saying is that there needs to be job creation, if not programs, then at least policies, economic policies, that encourage job creation where wages are at a standard that allow people to actually live.
Well, yes. And how we're going to come to that, I don't know. I mean, the living wage movement is one approach people in, at the grassroots are taking. But throughout the 90s, President Clinton was boasting that we had this great job-generating economy. Look at the Europeans. They had high unemployment. We were so much better than they were. And yes, the American economy was generating jobs, but so many of them were what could be properly called mech jobs, that didn't pay enough. No benefits, or very little by way of benefits. No career ladder. So I think it'd be a mistake if hard times made us focus simply on the quantity of jobs and forget that we already had a grave problem in the quality of jobs.
Barbara Ehrenreich, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. I spoke with her earlier today. And I want to come back to my guests, David Leonhardt of the New York Times and Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst. David, you wrote a very interesting piece that ran in Sunday's Times, and you made the point, it's something Barbara was almost hinting at, that we're kind of disagreeing with, that in fact, we do have a welfare state still, and it might be closer to Europe's than we think.
I think that's right. There's no – it is not Europe's. Our newspaper has carried some stories about the size of the disability program in Sweden recently, and the size of benefits in Germany was an issue somewhat in the recent election. But in the late 90s, there was a feeling that the United States economy had it all. We had a free market policy that saved us the high costs of social benefits and prevented us from creating potential incentives not to work. And yet we had a very humane economy, too, one in which almost everyone was doing quite well. And we don't want to completely dismiss the 90s boom. There is no question wages rose and that the labor market was able to absorb large numbers of immigrants and then some. But it now seems that we don't have it all figured out and that we are going to have some tough decisions coming up quite soon, in fact, about where we want to spend money to have a humane economic policy and where we draw the line and say we need to let the market work here. One of the soonest decisions is going to be whether to extend unemployment insurance. It will run out for many people. It has already been extended. It will run out for many people at the end of this year. The way the economy is going right now, many of those people are unable to find new work. And at this point, there has been no extension of it to the length that it was during the last recession.
But this one program, the disability benefit, there are no changes contemplated in that at the moment, even though you said that this year it will probably cost $69 billion to the federal budget.
That's right, an increase of 15% over last year, and it's the program's nearly doubled since 1990. Now, part of that, without question, is the fact that the rules have been eased a little bit, and part of it is that as a society we are older, and so you would expect more people in disability. But a big part of it is also that a large number of people, particularly men, seem to have made a decision that perhaps they used to have a $20 job, $20 an hour job. They've lost that job. Their prospects for getting another job like that are almost nil, and they've made a calculation that the disability benefit, while perhaps not quite the same size as a full-time paycheck that they could get, is close enough that it is not worth their taking the kind of job that Barbara Ehrenreich describes in her book.
Jack Beatty, this notion that there's still enough of more of a welfare state about in America than perhaps even the president would like to think. Do you agree with that?
Well, if that's what the numbers say, I'm not surprised if people are doing that. Look, 30 years ago, I was a truck driver here in Boston, and I work for a firm that doesn't exist anymore, nor do the following firms: M&M, St. Johnsbury, Adler, Holmes, Spectrum, McLean, Continental, B&M, Sandboard, Rappard. I could go on. What happened? Deregulation happened, and a whole category of worker simply disappeared from the American scene. That is to say, most city unionized truck drivers. There are firms, but there are darn few of them now. And what happened to those employees? I mean, if I were still in, I couldn't be in that business. What would I be doing? I mean, I suppose I could work in a service industry, but I mean, that would be to take a dramatic step down in life chances and in just common decencies of life. And that's happened to millions of workers all over this country. That's one of the offstage forces that is driving this phenomenon. Deregulation, globalization, all of these market freeing activities that, you know, steps that were depicted to us as deliverance. We'll get this sluggish economy going. Deliverance for the consumer, perhaps, and for the investor, but not for the producer and the employee.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Chuck is calling from Sherbourne, Massachusetts.
Hi, I'm fascinated by this. I've actually been following the news story over the past couple of days, and at the same time reading Kevin Phillips' book, Wealth and Democracy, and which pertains to this kind of thing. And what I find fascinating is that all this talk in the 80s and the 90s, that we are the great job machine, and that Europe just really has to go our way. It may not be the difference that we thought it was. And what's interesting to me about that is Philips also provides measures of wages and whether or not they've been going up and down, and ours have been more or less the same household income, in spite of the fact that we work harder or longer hours than even the Japanese at this point. And what are we getting for it?
David, let me bring David Leonhardt in on this.
There's no question that one of the biggest problems for workers over the last 30 years has been the increase in hours. The increase in the number of family hours worked is vast, and it has created one of the biggest problems for families today, which is how do they care for their children, how do they care for their aging parent, and have their jobs. And there are not easy solutions. It's clear that Europe's model has problems as well. Although the duration of unemployment in this country has risen significantly in the past 30 years, which is worrisome, and it's caused by some of the same forces that Kevin Murphy described earlier, it's still not as high as Europe. And so the United States has worse income inequality, but it also, on the whole, has less unemployment.
It's an interesting thing, if I can just interrupt you, David. That
please.
One of the things in Europe, the structural unemployment, is policies that actually make it incredibly expensive for businesses, even when they're in an expansion phase, to bring on new employees. I'm thinking particularly the French model, where the social cost that an employer pays to bring on a new employee, even when he actually needs him, and his inability to fire him once he's fired, just there's no incentive at all to hire. So there's always about 10% unemployment there. But the social safety net there is extremely strong. In Britain, where almost all of this was just completely obliterated during the Thatcher years, and her policies have been continued under the Labour government, you do have greater job creation than any other country in Europe, but you also have the attendant statistics that you would find in America of the greatest disparity in wealth is to be found in Britain, and the prison population, of course, it goes without saying, is larger in Britain than anywhere else as well. So it's like, it's not, when you think of Europe, it's not a monolith, mm-hmm. and you get both models kind of at work.
Absolutely. And it's clear that there is no easy solution. I mean, if we could divine exactly what the level of benefits were that would manage to keep people afloat during hard times, but would still encourage them to go out there and get jobs if at all possible, and if at the same time we can ensure fast enough economic growth that those jobs would allow them to live, we would have this figured out. But neither of those questions is easy.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. Helen is on the line.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. I've tried many nights to get you. I heard your discussion about the disability program, and one of the things I am really concerned about, I'm from Boston, Massachusetts, and I worked with a lot of first-time offenders and stuff like that through the system, and find that there are a lot of young men on drug programs that are collecting disability. And then you have people who, I have a personal friend who is a diabetic and just lost her leg and is fighting to get disability. I mean, she's got to go through unbelievable changes. I mean, I don't understand the screening of the system and the way they handle their caseloads.
Jack Beattie, do you have any insight on the way it works locally here in Massachusetts?
No, I'm going to defer to
David Leonhardt. Okay.
I've studied the sort of macroeconomic parts of the disability program. I am not an expert in how you qualify for it. But the people that we've talked to don't think that more people are cheating the system than used to. They think that I mentioned before the issue of aging. But really crucially, they think there are injuries that people work through when they can find a good job, but that they don't work through when they can't find a good job. And that, you know, that makes a lot of sense. If you can't find a good job and there is a government program that would pay you some portion of your salary for 0 hours a week and you're going to struggle to get by anyway, you might as well do that. And maybe there's some way to make some cash on the side. Maybe you can then care for a child in a way you couldn't.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Dana is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania.
Greetings. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, and this is directed to Mr. Leonhardt. Now, I'm not sure when the modern era begins when we talk about economies or employment, unemployment, but is it not, and maybe it's just my observation, that there's a certain amount of ebb and flow in both the economy and joblessness? Now, given the fact that given any administration, there's certain things that are passed and put through which are abominations. You know, we had 8 years of Reaganstein, then we had son of Reaganstein for 4 years, and now we may have grandson of Reaganstein. But isn't it a matter of ebb and flow, or is it a matter of some really abominable policies that caused this? And naturally, there's a slow catch-up.
So, Dan, it's ebb and flow is your question?
Yeah.
Okay. David.
Thanks. It is something of a matter of ebb and flow. I think the worrisome thing is we thought we were on the upside of that. The unemployment rate, if you sort of eliminate the recessions and just look at it more broadly, the unemployment rate seemed to be increasing and increasing and increasing all the way through the mid-'80s. And since then, it seemed to be decreasing and decreasing and decreasing. We got down to 3.9% in 2000, which was a 30-year low. And so it seemed like we were really on the positive side of the cycle. But what's important about the work that Kevin Murphy and others have done is that it points out that it is not, the last 15 years have not been nearly as good as we thought. And while on the one hand, I think I don't think this is a matter of policies causing this. I don't think that we had a boom in the 90s because of Bill Clinton and a boom in the 80s because of Ronald Reagan. I think it tends to be longer term trends. What's worrisome about this is that the longer term trends aren't going our way as much as we thought they were.
Jack Beatty.
Well, yes. I mean, and one of those is the relentless pressure on the union job, on the manufacturing job. I just came from Ohio. I was talking with a university president out there, and he said, you know, Ohio has the lowest percentage, or one of the lowest percentage of any state in the union, of people who finish a college, which really shocked me. And he said, the reason is the old habits still live on. And the old habits were, well, I worked in the mill. I had a good job. I didn't go to college. You can do that, too. Those habits live on even as the old mill has departed from Mexico and from Mexico to China and from China to Malaysia. The world, if you look at the world labor market as a kind of shape up, as in, you know, on the waterfront, the guys are all waiting for the job. The line begins here and it goes to Malaysia. It's very, very difficult to compete. And that's the big structural change that's pushing the button down on life chances for many, for what used to be the American middle class.
Yeah, and there's no Terry Malloy in Malaysia, is there, Jack?
No.
Getting ready to take a poke at John Friendly. We're talking about joblessness in America this hour. Connection on point, listeners, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking in this hour about unemployment, non-employment, just generally not working, we're trying to get a sense of the real scale of just how many people, adults of working age in the U.S., are not working. What does it mean, do you think, and we're talking about this with David Leonhardt, who's the national economy correspondent for the New York Times and On Point's resident news analyst, Jack Beatty. David Leonhardt, what do you think people who are making real investment decisions, I'm not talking about day traders, but real investment decisions in the American economy, what kind of statistic do they think of when they look at the unemployment statistics to get a sense of the strength of or weakness of the economy?
I think one of the problems is that in the last few years, the level of economic activity and the level of the stock markets have become so divorced from one another that we are now in a period that even if you're looking at the unemployment rate and you say, okay, it's probably going to rise for another 6 months or a year, which is what a fair number of economists think, and then it'll maybe stay there a little while and start to decline. Even if you see that, and even if you say, I want to get into the market before it really starts roaring, the stock market grew so much in the 90s, and it is still, according to the solidest measures, I think, it is still quite expensive, that even if you start to see the unemployment rate decline, even if you start to see a pickup in economic activity, it's hard to imagine that we are going to see really good investment returns for the next few years.
I need to phrase the question slightly differently. I'm just wondering, is there, in making investment decisions, is there, well, I'm going to sit this out because we still haven't bottomed out, because I just saw the unemployment rate and we still got a ways to go. If the unemployment rate is only counting a certain amount of workers' activities, I mean, where's the accurate measure for people who need to invest?
The better thing to look at on a month-to-month basis is the number of jobs created. We in the media could probably do a better job of making it clear that there are two different surveys that the Department of Labor does each month. In one, they go to households and they ask people, do you have a job? If you don't, were you looking for work? Things like that. They, of course, can't go out there and survey 40 million households. They survey a relatively small portion of households. And while it's perfectly adequate in terms of statistical sampling techniques, it is not nearly as comprehensive as the survey of businesses that they also do, because when you go to a business, you can capture hundreds or even thousands of jobs at once. So the better number to look at month to month, it's less volatile monthly, and it also doesn't suffer from some of these same problems, is the number of jobs created. You'll usually see on the radio, on television, in a newspaper, the unemployment rate went up 0.2% last month, and X number of jobs were lost. That's a better number to focus on. And it's important to keep in mind that the country is growing, its population is growing, so that having no jobs created in a given month means the unemployment rate is going to go up. We have to have a significant number of jobs, some people say 100,000, we have to have a significant number of jobs created each month in order to keep the unemployment rate simply flat.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mike is on the line.
Hi. One of the things I just correct that speaker was just there is that what you could do is reduce the number of immigrants coming into the country. Then you wouldn't have to increase the number of jobs as radically. We've had 30 million people come into this country in 10 years. That drives wages down and the cost of living up because of housing has gone through the roof, especially in the Boston area. Have you mentioned immigration at all as a problem?
Let's talk about immigration. You say it's a problem. You say it creates unemployment. David Leonhardt, is there any evidence to say that the wave of immigration actually has increased unemployment?
Well, it's not out of the question. It's possible that it has, but in many ways, the economy depends on an inflow of immigrants, the same way it depends on an inflow of capital, of money from other countries. I think one of the things that the rise in the disability rolls points to is actually the kinds of jobs that immigrants are willing to take that many native-born Americans are not willing to take. We were talking earlier about low-wage jobs. The fact is that immigrants coming from other countries are much more willing to take $5 and $6 an hour jobs when it is a large multiple of what they could make at home than Americans are, who perhaps were making $20 an hour and who were laid off from their job and have little prospect of getting another $20 an hour job.
Jack Beattie.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Cuban-American economist at the Kennedy School who agrees with our caller, who says the data agree with him, that basically the net effect of immigration is to depress wages for native-born workers and to bid up the cost of things like government services, for example, welfare, trash, whatever it might be, education, whatever it might be. So on net, immigration is a kind of minus for low-wage working Americans, for taxpayers, but not for employers, who, of course, can get workers for these jobs that have, you know, that pay less than $7 an hour. And to an American, someone born here, that doesn't look like anything. And to someone from another country, that looks like manna from heaven. And The immigration laws are a kind of conspiracy against the lowest paid Native American worker.
There's no question that in terms of, if you just simply think about the supply and demand question. If you have millions of immigrants coming into the country, you have more workers, and so it would tend, all other things being equal, to depress wages. I think, and I agree with that, I think the thing that's important to separate is the idea that the loss of the $20 an hour jobs for high school graduates in this country, that those jobs have gone to immigrants. By and large, they haven't.
Mike, I want to thank you for that call, but I just want to keep this going a bit. I mean, we're making an assumption that all immigrants are somehow struggling in rowboats and in containers from, you know, desperately poor third world countries come to the U.S. Now, in this enormous influx of 30 million that Mike was talking about, I don't know if that's an exactly correct statistic, but certainly tens of millions of people have arrived in the last decade. The census shows us that. Not all of them are the tired, hungry, squalid masses that we think of. Some of them bring major economic activity with them, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, there are a number of very highly educated immigrants who a good number of highly educated immigrants who have come into this country. By and large, though, it is not a population that comes into the country and competes for high-skilled jobs, by and large.
Maybe not in Boston, but they're playing cricket on the fields of San Jose as people come from Bangalore. And I think that it seems to me that there are significant numbers of people coming with middle-class skills. Time for one last call very quickly, I think. Sharon is calling from Duluth, Minnesota.
Hello. I work at a food shelf up here, and so I see folks that are on disability, and sometimes I really question, you know, disability there. And I also see low-wage working people. And I think a big factor here, which could also connect with union workers all over the country, comparing them to Europe, is health care. Mm-hmm. And so that a lot of these folks who work, even at $7, $8 an hour, because they have the health care factor to bring in, they are much less well off than the people taking these lower benefits but who have their health care covered. And so I think that's a big factor. And again, even with our competition with people, labor in other countries, I think unions have a bigger job here because of the health care not being part of our system.
Jack?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no question about that. I mean, the unemployed person who can't, you know, if you're poor in America, you can get medical care. If you're aged in America, you can get health insurance. It's just the people in between who can't. Somehow our social provision stops there. You know, in 1935, this was part of the original Social Security idea, cradle to grave, Franklin Roosevelt said. But in the end, he decided to leave health insurance out of it. It was a terrible mistake because that was the moment the political culture would have accepted it, and so much would have been so much more decent in American life, especially for unemployed workers who have to go to emergency rooms or ignore their illnesses. Because we have a system that ties health insurance to a job and to a good job.
I just have time to throw a quick question to David Leonhardt. David, just as you study the economy as the national economy correspondent at the New York Times, do you think that the bottom of the trough has been reached in terms of unemployment?
No. No. I would expect the unemployment rate is now at 5.7%. I would expect it to go up. I would assume that the non-employment rate, which is much harder to calculate, would go up somewhat too. When you have a recovering economy, which we may or may not have right now, but certainly when you have a weak economy, the first thing employers do is they try to work their existing workforce harder. They hire them to do more overtime, precisely because they don't have to give additional health care benefits. Then, when they're confident the economy is picking up, they begin to bring on new workers.
David, I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you so much for joining us. David Leonhardt, national economy correspondent for the New York Times.
Thank you.
Thanks, as always, to Jack Beatty, our senior news analyst in Hanover, New Hampshire. And you can continue this conversation online about unemployment and non-employment. Log on to onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. 40 years ago today, James Meredith became the first African-American to enroll in the University of Mississippi, and it didn't happen easily. The night before he enrolled, a mob rioted in an effort to keep Meredith out. Bricks were thrown, shots were fired, and by the time 30,000 National Guard troops and federal marshals could regain control of the situation, two people were dead, 200 were injured. The following morning, Meredith crossed a quiet campus and registered for classes. Last night, at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, Meredith spoke about the history he made 40 years ago, and here are some excerpts from that speech.
I went back to Mississippi in 1960 to fight a war, and to me, it was no different from World War I, World War II, Korea, which all I'd had friends and relatives to die in, but that's what it was to me. It was a war, and I went back to Mississippi with plans devised to break the system of white supremacy. I guess it was about 7:45 or maybe 7:30. We went out to get in the car, and it was the same marshal's car we'd been riding in. All of the windows had been shut out. They had to go back in the dorm and get some blankets put over the seat so the glass wouldn't cut us. And then we drove on over to the Lyceum building. And actually, at that time, it was later that I learned that that's where all of the rattling had taken place, because there wasn't nobody there when I went over there but soldiers. We went inside and registered. I was at war, and what soldiers do, they kill enemies. And if there's anything that was really surprising to me about the whole Mississippi thing, was that I survived alive. I mean, if I had been me, I would have certainly killed me if I'd been on the other side. My mission was to force the federal government into a position where they had to use organized violence to protect my rights of citizenship. And I can't overstress the significance of using organized violence to protect me and my kind and our rights of citizenship. There's only one way that we can become full first-class citizenship, and that is if that's what the whites in America decide. It ain't really up to us. It's up to white America. The reason why I'm so happy about what's happening at Ole Miss 40 years after I went there is because the leadership of that school. But it's also happening all over Mississippi, but particularly at that school. The chancellor made a statement recently that he believed in equality for everybody. When we get George Bush to say that, and all of the other whites take that and be serious about it, then and only then can we be complete full citizens. Until that time, I'm going to have to remain a soldier, and I'm going to have to try to teach everybody that I'm influencing to be a soldier until that day comes.
The words of James Meredith, the first African-American to enroll at the University of Mississippi. He delivered his speech last night at the John F. Kennedy Library. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.